Castle. This is side two, 371, tape number 371B, side two. January the 12th, 1979. There was an important story that came over the news this past week that I want to share with you and also use it as an example of how selective the news is around the country. I keep reiterating that, and we'll illustrate that over and over for you, because there are many young people taking these tapes who may go into political science, into law, into research, or who are doing it now, thinking people, and also older people too. This isn't just for the younger ones. This is for people to recognize how the media is distracted or separated, and how important it is, if you want to know something about a subject besides the superficial, how important it is to get as much information on that particular subject that there is. It doesn't matter what specialty you're in or what it is you select that you want to know. But if you want to know it well, you have to take it from many, many sources. I'm referring now to an article that was in the Washington Post this last week, dated January the 6th, and it also was in our Monterey Herald. It wasn't in the San Francisco Chronicle, and it wasn't in the Los Angeles Times, and I haven't gotten my Eastern papers from the 6th yet, but it's given credit to the Washington Post service, not Associated Press, United Press, or Reuters. The title of the article is Ex-Agent Turned Author Investigated, FBI Papers Found in the People's Temple Ruins. And this goes on to say that sensitive FBI documents, they were taken from Chicago, that are the makings of a book. An FBI agent is writing a book about illegal FBI activities. And the working papers that he had for this book were found down in Guyana in the ruins of the People's Temple in Jonestown. It says the bizarre discovery has triggered an investigation of this former FBI agent, who has turned author, and it says he's been cooperating with the Church of Scientology. It also led to an exchange of accusations between Charles Gary and Mark Lane. Charles Gary said the FBI went into his office a few weeks ago to get other copies of this FBI material. Sensitive FBI documents were in the offices of Charles Gary. The matter is considered serious because informants can be identified from some of the documents. One informant has already received a death threat as a result. These are working papers of the FBI using the names of their informants that were on the documents, and one of them received a death threat. Possible charges against this former agent for stealing the government documents will be barred, it may be barred, because of an understanding given by the Justice Department that he would be immune from prosecution. Now, what I'm saying here and reading and translating is the article saying that an FBI man formerly from Chicago had documents of the FBI with the names of FBI agents on them. They originally came from the office of Charles Gary, and they were found down in Jonestown in Guyana, and that the FBI agent, the former agent who stole them, may not be prosecuted for stealing them, which means he probably is an infiltrator who's working with them and exposing from the inside out because he's immune from prosecution. It said the former agent asked not to be identified, said that the material for his book that he's writing was found 3 weeks ago when six FBI men from Los Angeles arrived with a search warrant, and they found these down in Jonestown. They traced them to Charles Gary's office. Charles Gary and Mark Lane have divergent versions of how the former FBI man's material got down to Jonestown. Charles Gary had given a key to his office to Terry Buford, and he claims that she went in and copied the documents and took them down there. Mark Lane says that he had them and knew about them. An assistant of Charles Gary said that Terry Buford knew the agent's proposed book and had been introduced to him at Charles Gary's office a year ago. Terry Buford met this agent, and the article from the New Washington Post and the Monterey Herald did not identify the agent by name. But the San Jose Mercury, with a byline from the New York Times, the same date, on the same subject, mentions the FBI man by name. And the thing that's so interesting to me is that he turns out to be Mr. M. Wesley Swearingen, the FBI agent who was working for Larry Flynt and Mark Lane, who was at the press conference when Lane put a $1 million ad from Larry Flynt that I mentioned last week into the newspapers, 42 newspapers around the country, and said, "You bring to me your information on John Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and we'll give you a $1 million reward." And I mentioned before how dangerous it would be to turn this material over to Lane because these witnesses could be killed. And here he was working with Mr. Wes Swearingen of the FBI, and people innocently enough could turn this over. And it seems that already one agent has had a death threat whose name is on this list, who fears that because these documents have been taken away, that his life is in danger. The New York Times story goes on to say that a source reported having seen these papers said they included confidential reports to the Attorney General Griffin Bell of alleged FBI operations conducted out of the Chicago office. It said the memorandums and illegal papers had been prepared by M. Wesley Swearingen, a career FBI agent who retired in May of last year. But if he retired in May of last year, I did a tape, number 310, February 26, 1978, and he was working for Larry Flynt and Mark Lane at the time that he was still in the Federal Bureau of Investigations. If the New York Times is right that he retired in May, he was still working for the FBI when Larry Flynt was putting ads in the L.A. Free Press, the New York Times, and all over the United States for people to give them information of who killed John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. The San Jose Mercury story with the byline of New York Times said, Wes Swearingen worked in the Chicago Bureau office until 1971. That's the period where Charlie Bates worked in there. He also worked for the Watergate investigation, the FBI. Charles Bates was head of the FBI and must have been the chief over Wes Swearingen in Chicago at the time of the Fred Hampton, Mark Clark killings. And we know later it was in 72, the Dorothy Hunt plane crash in the summer of 72 after the Watergate story broke, or rather Dorothy Hunt's plane crash was in 73. Wes Swearingen worked in the Chicago offices of the FBI with Charles Bates, who then came to California to head the FBI Bureau at the time of the Patty Hearst kidnapping. And Wes Swearingen went down to Los Angeles with the FBI, and that's where the FBI was working with criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department. This article says he was transferred to Los Angeles Division in 1971. Several months ago, a source said, Swearingen made contact with Charles Gary, a longtime lawyer for radical causes. It had to be more than several months ago because we're talking now about January 79, and Charles Gary's best friend, Don Freed, was arranging the press conference down in Los Angeles in 1st of February of 78, a year ago, so that Mark Lane and Charles Gary and Wes Swearingen could gather material from people, use it for their own books to make a buck, get involved in these ghastly murders and this multinational, international financial setup known as Jonestown. The New York Times article said one government source said Friday that if the FBI documents found at Jonestown proved to match the original classified versions, those individuals responsible for removing them from the Bureau files and copying them and transporting them might be subject to federal prosecution. Well, is that Mark Lane? Is that Terry Buford? Is that Charles Gary? Because the other article says that the agent himself, Wesley Swearingen, would be immune from prosecution. So there's a tanglement here that I hope is clear to you. That points I want to make in this are that earlier in my tapes, talking about the press conference in Los Angeles, and after that press conference, I had lunch. I was at that press conference where Swearingen was presented And it was my son Marvin, I have a tape recording of the conference, asked, how can we trust you from the FBI working with Mark Lane now? The FBI wasn't so clean in the assassinations. He asked that question, and Mark Lane said, well, you have to give them credit for having seen the light and changing the course of their actions. Well, that was early in the year. That was in the first of the year of 1977, and Wes Warrington, according to this, didn't even retire until May. So Marvin's question was very accurate, and he, in fact, still was working for the FBI and working with Mark Lane and Jim Jones and getting documents. And also, worse than that, Wes Warrington was working side by side with Mark Lane so that any person who wanted a buck, who had information, thought he could collect that $1 million reward, was to turn it over to Mark Lane and Wes Warrington of the FBI and maybe dangle a reward. And I said before, why didn't they go to the House Select Committee if they wanted to solve the problem? They should have put a $1 million ad in and said, turn it over to Mr. Webster of the FBI or the Justice Department or the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and if there's a prosecution, we'll give you the reward. Turn it over to the legal authorities, because the House Select Committee had subpoena power. They had a $6 million budget. And yet a branch of the FBI was out in California. Mark Lane wasn't in Washington while the House Select Committee was working. He was working with a branch of the FBI in the offices of Larry Flint, and he could be a vacuum cleaner to suck up information. And as I say, as a result of these documents, one person has already received a death threat, and we don't know if anybody else has died. Right after that press conference, I had lunch with Lillian Castellano, who did this fantastic work on the Robert Kennedy assassination. I described that in my February 19th tape, 1978, how we had lunch together after the press conference, and the next week later, Lillian was found dead, and the LAPD had come in and gone through her material and files in her home after she was found dead. For some of you, it might be confusing that I go back and keep referring to past tapes, but that's the importance of this work in the past 15 years, is the continuity of the work. And I don't have transcribed tapes ready for duplication of the past 8 years on KLRB, 7 years, but since March of 77, the tapes are available, and because you can order those or have them already, you'll have to bear with us while I refer to the past tapes. And just look up that material yourself so that I don't have to repeat that information. It may sound vague because there's new people getting tapes every week and starting to subscribe, but the best I can tell you is get the past tapes and look it up and follow it in that way. Terry Buford, that lovely defector from the Jim Jones Temple, who said that she suspected that things were mildly wrong and that Jim Jones was crazy, and the commune down there was miserable, even though she said it was aware, obvious it was miserable, and they'd have to move. It was too hard and too rough. And she said this at a time that Mark Lane was on the press being paid $10,000 to tell you it was a virtual paradise, along with Charles Gary. I certainly think these men should go to court and account for the variances of opinions and how they're paid to sell something. You see, that's what public relations is, and that's what propaganda is. That the media is used, the mass media is used to tell you something 180 degrees different than what it really is. Terry Buford had an article, there's an article about her in the New York Times I didn't have time to quote last week. She talked about the temple activities and the establishment of a hit list of people that were to be killed, and she refers to Timothy O. Stone, the legal advisor for the temple, as the man who masterminded this. And, of course, that goes back to Stanford Research, and he was a lawyer from Stanford University who set up Jim Jones' first California operation in Ukiah after he had his brainwashing and treatment down in Brazil with the CIA from 1962 to 63, and a visit to Guyana, and then back to Ukiah, and then out to back to Indiana, and then back to Ukiah to meet Tim Stone, who was the next control of Jim Jones. Terry Buford said Mr. Jones ordered her to drug one of their temple members by the name of Sandy Bradshaw, who lived in San Francisco, and she said Mr. Jones didn't want to continue having an affair with Miss Bradshaw, but he wanted her to get drugs in California that would develop, in quotes, symptoms before she comes to Guyana so that she would not become suspicious that she was being poisoned. Jim Jones used to brag about the length of his penis and his sexual feats, but I think it's pretty hard to have sex from Guyana with a woman who lives in San Francisco, no matter how great he was. And the reason he wanted her drugged, according to this story, all cover story, he didn't want to continue an affair with her. Why does he have to have an affair with her? He has a wife and three mistresses down in Jonestown, plus all the men and women he wants. But the important thing about the story is that she was to develop symptoms before she got to Guyana so that the people down there and that she wouldn't be suspicious that she was being poisoned. Now, what kind of poison was she to receive, or what kind of poison did the others receive, and why were they killing Sandy Bradshaw, sending her from San Francisco to Guyana to kill her, while all the other people around this Jonestown that set up this operation are alive and may be rich someday? She said, Terry Buford, that Mr. Stone goaded Jim Jones into destroying himself and the People's Temple. Did you read the article this week that came out, a new document that the CIA used electroshock, turned people into vegetables, used two kinds of shock, one the normal shock treatment for convulsions and amnesia, and another one that would cause convulsions and guarantee that the amnesia would erase any knowledge of the use of convulsive shock. It caused excruciating pain, and they began that in 1951 and could erase the memory that they even had the shock. That's the kind of things the CIA was in. And I think that Jim Jones in Brazil could have been given any kind of mind control treatment while he's working with the CIA, because he could be signaled to destroy himself telephonically, as I referred to the Candy Jones book, and so forth. And Tim Stone was the one who kept goading him on. And of course, the cover story was the story of that son that they both seem to have fathered. And incidentally, the son hasn't been reported among the dead and could have been taken out on a boat by Mr. Blakey and is alive and in the Barbados or somewhere. Grace Stone and Tim Stone haven't said anything, and the excuse for killing these 910, 11 people was over this particular son that I don't even think died. Terry Buford said in the New York Times that Mr. Stone set up a diversion department whose mission was to manufacture floods of mail, telephone calls, and that he committed crimes. He had election fraud in San Francisco. He used the district attorney's office in San Francisco as assistant DA to protect the temple members and keep them in line, and that he smuggled money out of the country. Keep in mind that the prosecutor for a possible conspiracy for gun running, for drugs, for money being taken out of the country, for the murder of Congressman Ryan, for the murder of 912 people, for shipping children from juvenile halls down to be murdered, the man that would be prosecuting that in San Francisco is a Mr. Hunter, who shared a house with Tim Stone, kept his property there, was affiliated with members of the People's Temple, and he's supposed to be the prosecutor and hasn't even been removed in San Francisco from this particular case. Terry Buford went on to say that they signed confessions to various crimes, and I had noted that in my tapes in the summer of 77. She said Jim Jones was a maniac, and at the same time, I think he was manipulated into that. And that, of course, fits the same description of Adolf Hitler, a maniac with a terrific ego who himself accumulated nothing, really, no wealth or property, and could be manipulated into that. Terry Buford said that their intention was to go to the Soviet Union, where they have freedom of movement and freedom of speech. And that's pretty funny. And she said Jim Jones would have had freedom. I doubt if he would have had freedom or the fun of using his $26 million that he accumulated if he'd gone to the Soviet Union. Another important article in the paper this week is Herb Cain. Just a small article, January the 11th. that Jerry Brown wants to name Carlton Goodlett, the doctor, the San Francisco Black newspaper publisher, to the University of California Board of Regents. He's been trying to get him on the Board of Regents. You have to read some of the material of the Labor Caucus on Jerry Brown and his links to Ken Kesey and the drug cult, and to Stuart Brandt, who I've always called a Nazi, who's from Stanford Research, who got out the Whole Earth Catalog, that's an advisor to Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown, according to Herb Cain, wants to get Carlton Goodlett, the newspaper publisher. Now, Herb Cain calls him a newspaper publisher in the San Francisco Chronicle, yet Carlton Goodlett was the doctor for Jim Jones, the doctor for the people went down there, that went down there, the man who prescribed the drugs for the temple, who has not said, at least that I know of the grand jury, how those drugs got down there. They did get down there from nurses and doctors, and he had almost all of his patients, those black people, those black mammies, that entourage of several hundred black people that were shipped down to be killed, were patients of Dr. Carlton Goodlett, and I will share for you on these tapes part of a radio show he had on KGO, which I tape recorded, and I have to type up. But he's a doctor, and he prescribed medicine for these people and drugs and misdiagnosed, gave diagnosis of Jim Jones without putting him in a hospital or in an office. And even the newspaper covers up that he was a doctor who prescribed for these people, who gave them their drugs, and was down at Jonestown and was part of the support team of Charles Gary praising Jim Jones and praises him today as a great operation, a Schweitzer clinic, an eye-opener for the world. You should hear him talk about that Jonestown. And yet, here we have a woman that is going to be drugged, the Sandy Bradshaw, who's to be sent down there and be given symptoms before she arrives because she's going to be poisoned. And I wonder if Dr. Carlton Goodlett gave that medicine to Terry Buford or to this Miss Bradshaw, and he's to be on the Board of Regents of California. When I read that, I almost wish Catherine Hurst was back on the Board of Regents. I have a button collection. I have one button, where is Oswald now that we need him, after Lee Harvey Oswald was killed and Lyndon Johnson was president. There was a button that came out. You probably remember that. And then when Nixon was president, there was a button that came out, where is Lee Harvey Oswald now that we really need him? Of course, Oswald wasn't the assassin, and therefore I didn't really like the button that much. But I think I have to get a button made now. Where is Catherine Hurst now that we need her? Goodness knows if we're going to have Carlton Goodlett on the Board of Regents in Berkeley, California, the home of the SLA, these various drug kings that have been passing out drugs to the students and part of this espionage system of California. Can you imagine what it would be like to have a man like Carlton Goodlett as a Board of Regents appointed by Jerry Brown to the University of California? And all of this hogwash about People's Temple being a Soviet socialist enterprise is so ridiculous. This Terry Buford says in the article that maybe she didn't fit in because she wasn't like the other temple members, that she still might have been a capitalist, that she wasn't enough of a socialist when she left. After depositing all this money, it would almost turn you into a capitalist to see the deposits she was making. And again, there's a news blackout all around the country except for the San Francisco people. So those of you that live in the Bay Area in the media section around here will have to bear with me while I repeat this article on the tape, because the other people don't have it and I'm not getting it from any other paper or clippings around the country. So we have to share it with them, even though you may have the Sunday Examiner and Chronicle, January the 7th, 1979. It's called The People's Temple, $26 Million Financial Empire. The New York Times had a little bitty article on about page 17 or 18 on this. Nothing at all, really. And that's why I want to just give you a little resume of this article. It said that while Jim Jones preached socialism, and of course we know it was the kind of socialism he picked up in Brazil in 62 and 63, He had an empire worth $26 million with techniques ranging from selling his own hair to milking the life savings and property of people. The temple, People's Temple, has three numbered Swiss bank accounts in Panama worth more than $12 million and accounts in 10 other countries worth an additional $5 million plus. There is three bank accounts in Zurich, Switzerland, the Union Bank of Switzerland, three different accounts, Paris, France, and unknown deposits. Mark Lane was just recently over in Paris. Nassau in the Bahamas, which you know is a great socialist, communist country, the Bank of Nova Scotia, there, the tremendous fortune. Curacao, an account under the name of Jim Jones and Carolyn Jones. Virgin Islands, Grenada, small island out near Trinidad. Port of Spain, Trinidad, account at the Barclays Bank. That's interesting because Lieutenant Governor Dimely comes from Trinidad, who's been a staunch defender of Jim Jones. I believe he even went down to see the People's Temple. Money in Georgetown, Guyana, Caracas, Venezuela, $2 million in Venezuela. Panama City, Swiss Bank Corporation, three bank accounts. A Union Bank of Switzerland, and two in the Union Bank of Switzerland, and another one in Panama. The Bank of America, which is a great socialist bank, Fillmore Street in San Francisco. The United California Bank, another communist bank, and Montgomery Street in San Francisco, and another Bank of Montreal. Los Angeles, the Bank of America, another socialist account that Jim Jones had. This article tells how they invested $5 million down in Guyana. Boy, that settlement sure didn't look like $5 million to me. The view of the dining hall and the slave room where a bunch of old black zombies were kept packed 40 to a little shed and drugged out of their eyes, you know, just sleeping and eating bowls of rice. $5 million investment down at that camp. It tells of how he developed power and money. And a man named Richard Cordell, who was an assistant minister, was with him for 20 years, and he's filed a lawsuit against the church. 20 years means 1958, before he went to Brazil, that Jim Jones was doing all the shenanigans. And, of course, they try to tell you that he started his fortune by selling monkeys in Indiana. I just wonder, it'd be interesting to know just how many people in Indiana have monkeys or bought monkeys from Jim Jones. I'll bet you that there aren't 100 people that bought monkeys from Jim Jones in Indiana when he started to build his fortune. It said he became a multimillionaire by the time he emigrated to California in 69. A multimillionaire. Just take a little time off from Indiana and go down to Brazil and come back a multimillionaire. He had property in Mendocino worth $11 million by 1974. By 1977, the temple went international with banks around the globe. Funds in San Francisco moved out to Barclay Bank, down to Guyana, Georgetown, and the upper echelon temple members, I'm reading from the Examiner here, opened bank accounts in their own names and foreign accounts. Paris, Caracas, Zurich, Panama City, Georgetown, and so forth. And the Blakey girl, that's Mr. Layton's daughter, said she traveled from country to country with Terry Buford on mysterious financial missions. They went to Panama, and they went to London, where they spent 2 days doing research into banking. And then they flew to France and Switzerland. According to Debbie Blakey, they flew into Switzerland one night late so their passports wouldn't be stamped, and spent the night at a convent. Does the convent belong to the Pope Montini or the new Pope John Paul? The second was, where were the Catholic connections or the Vatican connections or the Mafia connections to the convent that these two chicks stayed in? Is it true that when you go from one country to another, if you go late at night, you can get through customs without seeing anybody? I mean, this just has to be so much BS that they can go late at night, avoid customs, go to a library in London and find out where to plunk their money down. This is part of the San Francisco Examiner Chronicle story about the funds and how they invested their money. They took this money overseas, millions of dollars, where it would pay 10% interest. A $1 million account in the Bank of Nova Scotia was closed out here. It says in San Francisco, but they used names, dummy corporations such as the Bridget, S.A., the Angelique. They used accounts, the names of Terry Buford, Carolyn Layton, and Marie Katsaris. Now, I think that's interesting because Debbie Layton's father is the one I told you, the family that have been in charge of the chemical warfare at Aberdeen Proving Ground in Utah, chief of biological research. Katsaras girl's father is a pastor in the Greek Orthodox Church that has been a conduit of CIA funds, and Terry Buford is the daughter of a Navy captain, an officer, and a Navy brat. So you have the Greek Orthodox Church, the Navy, and Army intelligence all bunched in there, and their three daughters, young daughters, Maria, Terry, and Carolyn, are making these various deposits around. They do more on another tape on some of these investments. They also told people coming down to the Promised Land they could bring with them tape decks and radios when they left for Guyana. And as soon as they arrived in Guyana, those were taken from them and sold on the black market. But I can't believe that the property they sold, and it's listed in this Examiner article, accumulated to $26 million. I believe more that Permandex and the assassination teams and the U.S. Medical Institute or the Defense Department agencies were funding drugs and weapons and doing these mind control experiments on assassination teams, and that this money was put into these banks for them. And I don't believe that this money just came from selling stuffed animals and houses. The poverty level of some of these black people was so low and their paychecks were so meager. I don't believe Jim Jones could accumulate a $26 million fortune. No way. Certainly not millions of dollars from when he left Brazil and went back to Indiana and then to Ukiah. Tape just goes too fast. There's too much material to give out in 1 hour, but that's it. So we have to close for this week. This is Mae Brussel and Carmel. Have a good one. We'll see you next week.